Hi, I'm Terry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
I'm so nervous. I gotta tell you guys something, though. You know how he announced no liquids in the building? This, for me, is the reason why I always think I'm the exception to the rule. My whole life has been like that. I always thought I was the exception to the rule. See? I don't just imagine it. I'm gonna leave it down there, though. Emma, can you hear me? Holy crap. All right. Anyway, I don't like microphones anymore. When I was early in sobriety, I could not wait to get my hands on one of these things. And I gotta tell you now, it's just not all it's cracked up to be. I really, really want to thank you for having me up here this weekend. This sounded like a really good idea like 8 months ago when Dirk asked me to do it. And the closer I got, the more nervous I got. So I don't know about you guys, but I like to know what's happening. So when I wasn't totally sure what I was walking into this weekend, because I've never been to a roundup where I stayed the whole weekend. And I was really nervous to see what I was going to encounter and what kind of people I was going to meet. It's funny to me, I still get nervous meeting alcoholics, even though I've been shown time and time again, no matter where I go, it's the same, you know? We're all alcoholics and we have those instantaneous connections, and I really appreciate it. I think I've breathed some of the sweetest air that I have in months up here. It's gorgeous. And after the crazy weather that we've had already this week, this is a really welcome break. Like I said, I used to really thrive on the idea of getting up here and telling my story, but now I know that it is absolutely my privilege to do this. It's service work. Any way I look at it, it's service work, and that is one of the most important things that I get to do for my sobriety. So I'll go ahead and get started. My sobriety date is January 16th of 2005. I have a sponsor, she has a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I have a home group. And it's been my privilege here recently to be able to travel to many different meetings, so I don't make it to my home group as much as I would like to or much as I have in the past. But I've gotten to meet a lot of new alcoholics since probably, especially within the last year and a half. And it's been a privilege, but it's also been a little trying. So that is where that is, and I'll probably get to that later. I grew up in a extremely Catholic military family, and it's not lost on me that we're sitting here in the chapel, and this feels so odd to be standing up here on where the altar would be, and it feels very odd. We moved a fair amount, you know, military family, probably every 2 years for a while. And my father did special investigative forces for the Air Force. So we never really knew what he was up to. You know, he was training, always training away. And we were told early on that you could pretty much only trust your family. So we were pretty tight-knit, you know, because we would move and we wouldn't really make friends. You wouldn't really have time. And so we were very close, and I believe sometimes now that familiarity can breed contempt, and we are people who love and challenge each other a lot in my family. I like to say that I'm from New York, but as my husband has run the numbers, I have been in the South more than I was in the North. I was, shh, don't tell anyone. I was born in New Hampshire, and our people hail from New York. And we spent quite a bit of time there when we were growing up, going back to visit the family. But in all actuality, I actually moved to Winchester, Tennessee when I was 6. And we went to the parochial school there, and my father worked at the Air Force Base in Tullahoma. And my mother taught school there, and she actually taught school up here. She taught at St. Andrews, and she taught at the University of the South. And I think it's not a coincidence that I get to come and speak up here. This place holds a very special place in my heart. And I, in fact, got some of my earliest resentments having to do with this mountain right here. So it's strange. And I can no longer go on with the story that I grew up in the North, because I didn't. I grew up down here. When we were living in Winchester, I started to believe that I became the victim of my circumstances. There were things that happened, choices were made on my parents' part, choices were made for us. Going to a Catholic school didn't really help. We had nuns, we had for real nuns, and they were not nice. And it always seemed like things were being done to me or decided for me. And so I learned very early on, or I decided very early on, that I was just a victim of my circumstances. And I carried that for a really long time. Circumstances were my problem, especially when I first got sober, until I learned otherwise. So we lived in Tennessee, and you'll have to pardon me for hesitating a little bit. I usually skip right over the part where we lived here, because there's not a whole lot of fond memories with it. It was a tough time. It was a tough time for our family, and it was a tough time for my parents, and things were changing a lot. And we were away from our family, and everyone lived up north, and so it was difficult. In 92, we moved to Huntsville, Alabama. This was the last assignment that my dad got, and we moved down there. We commuted for a while, but that's a long drive. When you're Catholic, you start drinking kind of early. I think I had my first drink when I was 8 for communion. And I got to tell you, I didn't get drunk, but I certainly discovered that I loved what communion wine did for me. I would take the biggest gulp I could out of that cup. Like, I would get it, and I would, you know. And I would get back to the pew, and the nuns would smack me in the back of the head, because they could see what we were doing while we were up there, right? Only wet your lips. This is what they would tell us. Only wet your lips, please. So I get back to the pew, and it would be so warm and sour, and this was something that I did not experience in regular life, and I knew that there was something kind of special about it. I didn't start drinking then, but I knew that I liked whatever that feeling was that I got from that. I started drinking when I was 15. I was working a job where I got to work with a bunch of older people, and they would invite me to go to weekend parties. And the first time I got drunk, it was on Zima, because it looked like 7-Up. You could put it in a cup, and you could carry it around, and no one's going to bother you. It looks like a soda. So I'm drinking this stuff, and you know the feeling where you get there, and you're nervous, and you're around all these people, and this is the first real party I've been to. And as the night goes on, I am having the most spectacular night of my life. It never occurred to me that the other people at the party weren't having the most spectacular night of their lives too, but to me, that's what it was. I, of course, just like most alcoholics, you know, I got sick, and I didn't really think too much about it. I thought that's how you drink, you know? You drink till you get drunk, and then you throw up, and then you feel better, so you can drink some more. You know, and it never occurred to me that the other people there were not doing this same thing. After that, any time that I could, I would go and drink. I would go out with these people on the weekends, and it started to become something a little more during the week. My parents were not afraid of us drinking. My parents are not alcoholics. We have one uncle who might have been a heavy drinker. He was the cool uncle who always had a beer, who had the van with the door that didn't quite shut. And so we'd have to hold the door shut when he rode around with him. And he was laughing all the time. So the only thing that I ever saw of anyone who drank in excess was this really happy guy with this crazy van. You know, and that seemed like fun to me. There didn't seem to be a problem with that. But like I said, my parents didn't drink. I think I've seen my dad drink one time. I shared a beer with him one time, and it was the most awkward drink of my entire life. I didn't know how to talk to him because I like to drink in excess. I am a heavy, drunken drinker, and my father has a beer, and it's really hard to have a conversation with your military father while you're drunk, you know, and trying to look like you're there. Paying attention. So we never really drank together. But anyway, so they weren't worried about us drinking, so they had a liquor cabinet, and we had access to it. When they were growing up, the drinking age was 18, so they figured we could drink if we wanted. If we weren't going somewhere, it didn't really matter. I took full advantage of that. They always had a fairly well-stocked cabinet, which always seemed strange to me because they never drank. And they never had people over. So I don't know who all that booze was for except for me. So I drank it, you know. And there were a couple of times that my mom, I think, saw me a little tipsy at the house, but she didn't really say anything. I think she saw it as perhaps a bonding moment for us since my dad was training so much. And so it didn't really, there weren't any consequences early on. In our family, appearances were extremely important, and this produced a lot of problems. I was a very strong, middle-of-the-road student, because if I could do that, then I wouldn't, my parents wouldn't bother me too much about school. So I stayed pretty on the straight and narrow. Now, when I could get off, when I knew they weren't going to be around, when I knew they weren't paying attention, then that was my time. But I did whatever I needed to do to make sure that they were going to stay off my case. And luckily, I have a younger brother who is exceptional at getting into trouble. And I have an older brother who requires a lot of attention. And so I didn't really have to worry about them paying too much attention to what I was doing, which is the way I liked it, you know. As I was finishing up high school, I became a completely different person. I decided that the best way to continue doing what I wanted to do, which was drinking, and by that time I had been introduced to some other substances, was to completely change the way I looked so that people wouldn't want to approach me. Ow. When I still looked like this when I first got into sobriety, and I think when I was 17 or 18, I started going, I'm sure you guys are familiar with the goth movement, you know, right? Yeah, it's not. So, all black, heavy black eye makeup, leather bands, spiked leather collars, dyed my hair like a blue-black color, I was wretched. I was just wretched. Not wretched, you know, looking, but I was miserable all the time, and I adopted the permanent face of, what? This is how I looked at everyone. What? Why are you bothering me? I would like to say that I could live up to that look, but it was all a front. I was too afraid to actually go that far. I was too actually afraid to live that life, but I really wanted to look that way so at least the people who cared about me would step back a little bit. I remember my mom saying to me one time, "I just don't even know who you are anymore." And I looked at her and I said, "Good. Good." There was nothing I loved more when I was a teenager than torturing my mother. And She didn't deserve it. Very few mothers do. But I'll tell you how she saved my life in a minute. But I tortured her, and we had some horrendous fights, and I know that the daughter that she wanted, I could not be for her at that time, you know? And I took a lot of pleasure in taking that away from her, and that was one of the hardest amends that I had to make. In our family, you went to college. That was just, you just go to college. Now, there wasn't any money for college, but you find a way to go. So I couldn't go away to college because my grandparents had convinced my parents that if I went away to college, I would end up pregnant. I don't know how that happens, but apparently that happens if you go away to college. So I didn't go away to college. I stayed at the university at home, which is the University of Huntsville, and I wasn't allowed to move out of the house. Now that may sound weird to people because you would think you're an adult and you can choose your own behavior, but I gotta tell you, when you grow up in a military family, your choices aren't your own until you get out. At least in mine, anyway. So I wasn't allowed to move out of the house, so the best thing that I could figure out how to get out of there was to get married. So I found myself a husband, a gentleman, a guy, who looked like I did, had the same affect that I did, I thought drank like I did, and we got married as soon as possible, and I moved out. Being married to someone like us, like a drunk like me, is horrible for another person. He never got the opportunity to go to Al-Anon or anything like that. He didn't have a drinking problem, even though I thought he did. But I was absolutely horrible to him. Horrible. Because all I wanted was what he could give me, and what he could give me was a stable life away from my parents. And he paid for me to do things like pretend to go to school and stuff like that. And I was able to make amends with him later, but it took time and it was work. And I can say now that if I see him, I don't have to duck. We don't have to duck each other, you know? And that's something that I never thought would happen. We were married for about 2.5 years, and couldn't think of a better way out. I don't know about you guys. I don't know if any of you grew up Catholic. I'm sure some of you did. Yeah. And when you grow up Catholic, you don't get divorced. That's just one of the big ones. And so I got very, very desperate because I couldn't see a way out of this marriage. I was drinking all the time. I would pretend to go to school and wait till he left the house to go to work, and then I'd come back, and I'd drink all day. And right before I knew he would get home from work, I would tidy up a little bit and try to make myself look presentable and pour myself something that looked like I had just made it or something that was not, an alcoholic beverage. And he would come home, hi, how's your day? Oh yeah, school, whatever. You know how we do. We put on that good front. We can make people believe. People who are unsuspecting, people who care about us, do not expect these lies to come from us, And we take advantage of that. Anyway, so I was very desperate at the time. I was drinking every day. I am a blackout drunk driving alcoholic. Whenever I drink, I gotta go. I gotta get in the car and go. I cannot sit still. I can't sit still now. But really, when I'm drinking, and I knew it was a bad idea. And text messaging had just started to become popular back 2001, 2002. And, there is nothing more dangerous than a drunk driver with a cell phone. Yeah. And I would think that I could do all these things. Alcohol just makes, it makes us think we can do anything. So I'm text messaging and I'm driving my car, and I was certain that if I came upon a roadblock or something like that, I could totally charm my way out of it. I just had that confidence. Man, I was a bar drinker too. I loved going to the bar. You know that the applause that you got when you came in, Bill? You know, you had to work 58 years staying sober to get that? Yeah? I always wanted that applause for no reason whenever I went in anywhere. Yeah. And you can get that at a bar. You can get that at a bar because there are always people happy to see you because you are worse off than they are. Yeah. I loved bar drinking because I had my stool and people knew my name. I was Norm, a little cuter. But, you know, people were happy to see me, so I thought. You know, of course the bartender was happy to see me because I threw money around like I had it. I didn't. I had my husband's credit card. But you got to pay that back eventually, or he did. And I would go to these bars, and I would hang out all night, and I would tell myself that these were my friends, and I was going for music, and this was a valuable way to spend time, and that was my life. I would get up, I would go to work. This is at the time when I was working. I would go to work, I would get off work, and I would go to the bar. And I would hang out with people that I didn't really know. My husband didn't know. He would go home, and I'd stay at the bar. It's a wonderful way to ruin a marriage. Anyway, I couldn't see any way out of that marriage. He was miserable and I was miserable and I was wrecking his life. And those are the things that I tell myself when I'm, in my cups, you know, that I'm wrecking your life. I need to do something about this. I need to get out. And so since you don't really get divorced when you're Catholic, I figured, well, I'll just kill myself. Because I had to tell you that that's about the same in Catholic. You know, they're about equal weight sin-wise. But I figured I wouldn't have to deal with the aftermath. So, like we do. And obviously it didn't work. But it was one of those nights. I had it all planned out, and I thought it was going to be this great triumphant feat. And I remember waking up in the hospital with my mother standing over me. Somehow she had gotten there. And this look of just absolute despair, just total, she couldn't do anything else for me, you know? And I will never forget that look on her face, never. They promptly put me in a detox unit. And I got to spend 4 days at the Crestwood Detox talking to people and telling them things they wanted to hear. And that's when I first got introduced to AA. And, how we take meetings in treatment facilities? That's what these guys were doing. And I can't remember who they were, but one of them was wearing cowboy boots, and I remember that because I couldn't look anybody in the eye, so I knew what kind of shoes you were wearing. And this guy was wearing cowboy boots and a suit, and I was kind of offended. I don't know why. Like, why would you wear cowboy boots with a suit? And it was a bunch of women, and we were all angry because we couldn't have coffee and we couldn't have cigarettes and we couldn't have men, and, you know, and these guys wanted to bring us a meeting, and at the end of the meeting, they wanted to hug, because, you know, we're alcoholics, and we like to hug people, and, you know, women in detox just don't want to hug you. So my first impression of AA were these guys coming in wanting to be overly friendly, and I thought they were carrying Bibles, because they had their big books. And I didn't know, I didn't hear anything they said. I was so angry about being there. All I could think of was getting out. And that was not it for me, you know? I had to go out and finish up, I hope. I got out of there and I felt strong because I had been off the booze for a few days. And so I told my husband I want a divorce. And he didn't fight me too much because, I mean, I had tried to kill myself. I tried to kill myself, as he thought, to get away from him. So, I mean, what are you going to fight about? So we separated, and I spent the next year drinking myself to death. My life became very narrow. The people that I talked to became very few. And my desperation and my hopelessness became much, much deeper. And I took myself to that dark place that we all absolutely need to get to before we get sober. That place that seems like there is no return, that there is no one in the world who understands how difficult it is, that dark, lonely place. And I had to get there. On October 31st of 2004, Halloween used to be my favorite holiday. I mean, you can imagine what I looked like with the collar and the leather and all, you know, so of course, Halloween, my favorite holiday. Every day was Halloween for me. I had gone to my bar that I always went to, and I had been out the night before, and I had told myself that I wasn't going to drink. You know, I had started to really start to experience some real consequences from my drinking, and I thought maybe there might be something wrong, and I couldn't put my finger on it, but something didn't feel right, and so I told myself I was not going to drink that night. I was just going to go and enjoy the music. I was just going to go and see my friends and my very favorite bartender. And with alcoholics like us who are also love the bar life, when you walk into the bar, your bartender has your drink ready for you. And because I am an alcoholic who cannot say no, even when I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I don't want a drink, when I don't want that drink, I will take it anyway. And once I start, I can't stop. And I was so very, very fortunate that night to have my moment of clarity. I had gone into the bathroom, because we know that in the bar, bathrooms are very classy places. And I'd gone in there to spend some time thinking about my life. And I remember at one point, amidst the stickiness of the floor and the flickering lights, and looking down at my legs and my arms and realizing that I'm covered in bruises. I'm covered in giant, these are not like, oh, I bumped into something. Not those bruises. The bruises that we get when we're in a blackout and we don't know what happened. And I looked down and I thought, there is something very wrong with this. This is not right. I cannot do this anymore. And I am so, so grateful for that nasty bathroom with those disgusting walls and flickering lights, because in that moment, I saw what I was and I saw what I had become. I told you earlier that my mom saved my life, and I've told her this. And, you know, she brushes it off like any good mom. But she had kicked me out of the house by this point. I had been living with her after my divorce, and she had just gone through a divorce. Now, they didn't really equate. She had been divorced after 30 years. I had been divorced after about 2. And so my feelings always came first. It didn't matter that she was trying to put her life back together. I took over her life. You know, I was drinking every night, coming in. She didn't know where I was. She didn't know who I was with. And she was having to worry about me while trying to put her life back together. And she came to me one day and she said, I can't do this anymore. I need you to leave. Huh? You're my mom. She says, no, I need you to leave. I can't handle this. And I was shocked. I was shocked because my mother had always been a pushover, so I thought. And I don't know where she got the strength, but I'm really, really grateful that she did. I know it's a God thing. And so 2 months after that was when I found myself in that bathroom thinking, I can't do this. I cannot. I had missed my shift at work the next day, and so I called my boss to give her, you know, any number of excuses that we have for missing work when we're drinking. And instead of giving her the fabulous excuse that I had come up with, I said to her, I think I have a problem. I couldn't really tell her what the problem was because I wasn't exactly sure. But I said, I think I have a problem. And she says, I know. We were going to tell you that you need to do something about that or find another job. I didn't know when she was going to let me in on that, but I'm glad I brought it up first. And so I said, I don't know what to do. Well, luckily, her husband was familiar with AA, and he had been sober for quite a number of years at that point. And she says, I think you should call Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. And she didn't give me a phone number. She didn't do anything. She just said, I think you should call Alcoholics Anonymous. And so this is when I start working for my sobriety, because that phone book is really, really heavy when you need to call someone for help. And I picked up that phone book, and I started looking through, like, where are you going to find Alcoholics Anonymous? Thank God it's at the front of the book. And I called the number, and we were talking a little bit about this last night, maybe, after the meeting. An older guy answered the phone, and I know without a shadow of a doubt that had a woman answered that phone, my sobriety date would not be what it is. I could not submit myself to women who might see through my bullshit. Women were dangerous. So this older guy answered the phone, and he told me this meeting at the fellowship group on Monday night at 8 o'clock. And that suited me just fine, because that meant I didn't have to close down the restaurant that I worked in. So I, my boss took me to my first meeting, and I went in, and at that time I was also a chain smoker, and so I was very relieved to find out that we could smoke in these meetings. But I sat in the non-smoking section and promptly got yelled at by an old-timer. I didn't know what I was doing. It was also a closed meeting, and I had my boss with me, and so that was like strike number two. I came to love those old-timers very, very much after I'd been sober for a little while, because I knew why they were doing what they were doing. But when I was first, that first meeting, I was terrified. I mean, my eyes must have been like as big as saucer cups. Like, I could not, we went in, and it's an 8 o'clock meeting, and at the home group at the time, there were a lot of older men at the meeting. And I just could not see how I was gonna have, that I was in the right place. I mean, I was 23. They were older than that, and everybody was laughing, and I was still raw. I couldn't stand to be touched. I couldn't stand to be looked at. I couldn't stand to be talked to. I mean, just raw. And so I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. And after a week, I decided that Friday night meeting was it. This wasn't for me. I was going to go back to the bar, because I knew that. I was familiar with that. I was comfortable with that. And it was awful, but I was going to make it work somehow. So I go to this Friday night meeting, and they had this lady from, so that was the fellowship group, and this lady was from the Huntsville group. And she's about this tall. And she, in my mind, I looked at her and saw somebody's bored housewife. That's what she looked like to me. Now, at the time, I didn't realize that for a number of years, I had been somebody's bored housewife. To me, I lived a much more exotic life than that. But that's what this lady looked like, and I thought, there is nothing that this woman is going to say that I need to hear. You know, so I'd sit in the very back of the room, and I would chain smoke my cigarettes, and at that time I was still ducking out before the Our Father, you know, but not fast enough so that you couldn't see me. I wanted to make sure you saw me leave, because I don't pray. And she got up there, and she told my story. I don't know what she said, but I know for the first time, and I don't even know how many years at that point, I sat in the back of the room and I cried like a little baby. Real tears. Not self-pity, not, you know, manipulative tears so that you'll give me what I want. Tears that this person was speaking directly to me, and I could feel it. And it was a simultaneous feeling of hope and dread, because all of a sudden I knew I was in the right place. And that was as equally scary as it was something to look forward to. I didn't change my behavior much after I started going to meetings. I don't even remember what time we started. I didn't change my behavior much. I still would go to a meeting, and then I would go to the bar right after the meeting. I didn't drink. I sat there and got crazy. And I would sit, and I would order a cup of coffee at the bar, because bartenders love that. And I would drink my coffee, and I would watch everyone drink their beers, and I would just seethe. And I would be so angry, and I would look at them, and I would hate them. And I would, you know, drink, we'd watch them drink with impunity, you know, and it drove me nuts. And I was doing it to myself, but I liked it because I was feeling something, you know. So I would sit there, and I did this for months, and I just got crazier and crazier. The lady that told my story, I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said yes. And I started meeting with her, but I wasn't working any steps. She would suggest that I do things, and I wouldn't do them. She would ask me to read the book. She would tell me, next time we meet, I'm going to ask you what's on the first page of the book. We would meet once a week. I wouldn't crack the book for a week. And we'd meet, and she'd go, what's on the first page of the book? The title? No. Apparently the first page of the book is blank. Little test. Little sponsor test. I hated that. I wasn't ready to do the work, and so she would give me these little, you know, see if I was ready. But she hung in there with me. And I got crazier and crazier, and I had headache for 3 months when I first got sober. I mean, I was just really miserable. And in January of the next year, of 2005, I just couldn't take it. Not working steps and staying sober, it was too much. And so I went and found a friend of mine who was a barback, and I always knew that he had some herbal refreshments, and I thought I would drop in on him just to say, hey, and I knew I could always get attention from him, which is the other thing that I craved at this point. And so, of course, you know, we partook, and then as soon as we finished smoking, he says, do you think you could leave? Because I would really like to enjoy this by myself. What? Like, I just blew my sobriety date so I could get kicked out of this guy's house. I was so angry. And it occurred to me that, is this what I want to give up? I mean, is this what I want to do with my life? Is this what I want to go and beg people to spend time with me? And beg favors? And be that unwelcomed hanger-on, you know? And when I got back to a meeting, I pursued the program with a zeal that I did not know I had inside of me. Because I saw what I could go back to. It was there. It was waiting for me. All those people are still there. Most of them. And I could have that back anytime I wanted. But maybe why not try this other thing? And so I started. And I started hitting the steps hard. And as soon as I got to step 4, I got a boyfriend. Because that's what you do, you know? I needed a distraction because I don't want to think about me. I want to think about somebody else thinking about me. So when I was 5 months sober, I started dating a gentleman who was in the program quite a bit longer than I had been. And my higher power gives me precisely what I need when I need it. I know that beyond a shadow of a doubt. I did not have a sponsor who told me to wait. She said, you're going to do what you're going to do, so let's just keep focused on the steps. So we would still work steps, and I get into this relationship. I don't know, for me, if I would have been able to stay sober had I not been dating someone. And I know that sounds really weird. But to me, it makes sense, because I know me. And this gentleman brought something into my life that I had never known before, and that was the joy of service work, because I was not ready for what the big book had to offer me just yet. I needed to get involved. I needed to keep my hands busy, I needed to keep my brain busy, and I needed to keep moving. And so we would service work, service work, service work. Anything that was available, I would do. I would take, as soon as I could, I would chair meetings. I would take positions at the home group. We would go to area. We'd be involved in district. And I just was on this guy's coattails because he knew the deal, you know? And I needed that. I needed somebody to be telling me where to go and what to do to help people. During the time that we were together, he started doing treatments for interferon treatments for Hep C. And I don't know if any of you guys have experienced this, but it is an extremely difficult thing to do. It takes a tremendous amount of courage. I had never had any practice caring for anyone in my entire life. Not the way that I was needed to care for this person. I remember nights when we would sit there and he would have to do shots and pills, and we would sit there and we would cry because we had to have these needles in our house. And he would have to give himself shots, and we would have to set up his pills and his care routines, and it was a very seemingly hopeless way. And it was very difficult, and I was asked to do things, not by him, but just by life, that I didn't know if I could do. And whereas I used to have a confidence in myself when I was drinking, I didn't have that confidence. And this relationship showed me what my higher power could do. Because this person could not be my higher power. I learned that pretty early on. But I needed something. I needed something to latch on to because I could not do what I needed to do for this person. And I needed help. So I remember we lived in this trailer out near Gunnersville in Alabama, and I can remember kneeling on this linoleum floor in the kitchen in the middle of the night, begging my higher power to show me what to do. Because at 25, 26, you're not ready to care for somebody, especially if you just come off the booze. Like, you can barely take care of yourself, you know? And the problem was that I wasn't realizing that I didn't have to do this alone. I was not asking for help from the women in the program. I was not turning to my family. And the pit that he was going down into from being sick all the time, I was going with him. And at 3 years, I was suicidal again. I didn't want to drink because I knew where that would take me. But I could not continue the way I was going because the power was not there. I was not asking for it. I wasn't looking for it. I thought if I could just manage, if I could just make him better, then everything would be fine. And you can't do that. So because I didn't want to go back to drinking, and I really knew that offing myself at this point wasn't very good, you know, I had service responsibilities that I had to show up for. I got a new sponsor. I got a new sponsor who was familiar with the book. And she began to unweave the mystery that is the big book for me. And I started to get the meat of this program instead of just being busy all the time providing, you know, trying to be there and try to be everything to everybody and be super AA person. I started to understand what it was to have a solid foundation. And I started to understand what this program is really about. It's about finding a power greater than myself, which I so desperately needed. Obviously, you know, that relationship didn't last. That the man I'm married to is not that man. It's a different guy. But my higher power that I found through that relationship, that was the start. It was small, but I clung to it so hard because it's what I had. It's what I had to work with. I left that relationship, and I had, honest to God, never lived on my own. Never. Went from my parents to my husband to a roommate with my mom. You know, I lived with everybody but myself. So I got to do that for the first time, and it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. I used to cry every night in my little rental house because I didn't know how to be alone. I didn't know how to be in my own space with me, with God. It was terrifying. And it didn't matter to me that, you know, I would just cry and cry, and then I'd fall asleep. And then I'd get up and do what I needed to do the next day. And then I'd come home and I'd be terrified. And what I found out was that this was the process of me connecting to my higher power on a personal level. I used to be so embarrassed about praying. When I first came into the program, my sponsor, of course, would suggest I get on my knees and pray. And I can't tell you, I would be alone in my room. I had a roommate at the time. And I would be alone in my room, and I would be so embarrassed to get on my knees and pray. Nobody's there, just me. And I would be so embarrassed. And I would sit on the edge of my bed and twirl my cigarette around and think, am I going to do this today? No. And so I'd have my cigarette, and I'd go. Well, when I was living in this rental house, I started to get a routine. I started to get what would be now what makes my day feel complete, you know? And I do specific things, and I pray specific prayers, and that started to comfort me in my fear and my feeling alone. That connection with my higher power started to bolster me, started to make me the person that I needed to be in order to live in the world as a sober woman. I got back into school for real this time. I actually went. I had the very dubious work of bringing a grade point average up that was close to nothing, and I managed to do that. I managed to work as hard as I did at that, as I did it as sobriety. And because I was taught how to study the big book, I learned how to study other things too. You know, imagine that. About six years ago, I got an awful big resentment because Dirk over here started a big book study for men. And I was so resentful because now there were going to be these guys in the group who knew more about the big book than I did. Never mind the fact that they were probably reading it twice as much as I did. But I was really upset and I was really frustrated because I didn't want to be left out. And I was very fortunate that when they opened up the group to everybody, when it came time, when it was the right time to open it to everybody, my sponsor says, well, why don't you go? Like, I'm not going to that group. No. He started it, and it was only for men. I did eventually go because that was a way to get over my resentment. And there are some meetings that you go to that become pivotal meetings in your life. You know, some people go to specific meetings, like the Saturday 8 a.m. meeting or something. You see all your people there. This meeting has become that for me. It frustrates me that I don't get to go as often as I would like because I had the opportunity to be working on my master's degree. But when I go and we study the book, and we study the book with people who are interested in studying the book, who are interested in knowing what it is we do here and why it is we do what we do and what it's about, there is something that lifts me, that lets me go back and live the life that I feel like my higher power has in mind for me, you know? And I get to walk sponsees through the book with this greater understanding. And I don't have to tell them what to do. I get to show them why we do what we do and where it is that it says it, you know? And I didn't have that before. So I'm very grateful for the sponsor that I have. She always challenges me. You know, anytime I'm upset about something, she always challenges me to do the thing that I really don't want to do. And she knows that's the way to get me to do it, you know. Also, around that same time, after living on my own for a while, Marty over here, We met when I was about a month sober, and I thought some old-timers in our group introduced us. Because we were around the same age and we were both artists, that was the only reason. I thought he was supposed to be my AA boyfriend, and he was supposed to help me stay sober. That was not the case. We don't do that here. But and we started a friendship, and we got to see each other in meetings, and we got to see each other go through some really difficult times. And after, oh gosh, what was I, 4 years sober-ish, we kind of looked at each other one day and thought, I think I'm supposed to be with you. No, for real. Not in a recovery sense, but I think this might be a good fit. And when we began talking, we began slow. And we talked to our sponsors about how we should pursue a sober relationship. Because even in sobriety, even after I had had this, you know, several year relationship with this other gentleman, I still did things the alcoholic way, you know? So we started slow and we got to know each other. And we got to know each other in the way that the book suggests. You know, there's an order in the 12 and 12. If you don't know where it is, it's in there, go find it. And we started that way. And I got to grow my faith and grow my recovery while learning how to share my life with someone in recovery and not live through their recovery. This is mine. I'm here for me. And after a year and a half, we got married. And who knew? Who knew that marriage in recovery could be so amazing? You know? I am so, so grateful. He has a God of his understanding, and I have a God of my understanding, and they're not the same thing, I don't think, and they don't have to be the same thing, but we are on the same page. When I used to be so embarrassed about praying in the morning, I get the opportunity to get up and pray with him in the morning. Together. This is unheard of behavior for someone like me. Sometimes I look at my life and I can't even believe that this is what I get to do. I'm in the process now of working on a master's degree, and the joy that I feel through recovery, well, I mean, you get to see it. I'm like a freaking kid bouncing off the wall. I never would ever show anyone how happy I was, because if you showed people how happy you were, they could use it against you. It made you vulnerable. So I would always be affected, and I would always be angry, and I would always be closed off, and I would be terrified to be happy in front of other people. I don't have to worry about that today. You know, it seems like the longer I get to stay sober, the happier I get, the more free I get, the bigger my God gets, and the more I can let you in. And not be afraid of you. I'm not afraid of what you're going to do to me. I have the opportunity to have you in my life. I have the opportunity to get to know what it is about you that God saw fit to put you in my life. What am I supposed to learn from you? How are we supposed to affect each other? I mean, these are the things that I get to think today. And when I think about that person who couldn't see any hope in life, who couldn't put the booze down, who was using up everybody and everything in their life, I am floored that this is how I get to live. I mean, even just a fraction of what I have now would have been enough, you know? It's a, I get a little emotional. I feel very preachy up here. This is a... It's a way of life unlike anything else I've ever seen. Not like I've ever experienced, because I've only experienced this one way, but anything I've ever seen. And I know a lot of people now who come from a lot of different walks of life, and they see something in people like us that attracts them. They want to know what it is about us. Why are we happy? Why are we free? You know? It's hard to explain to people who aren't alcoholics. It's hard to people who haven't been to those depths, you know? But I can still bring something to their life. Because of what this program has given me, I get to take what I learned here and live it in my life, and not just for alcoholics. This is not just for alcoholics. We get some of our greatest joys with people in AA. We get the bondage of friend, the friendship. We get the camaraderie. We get the people who are in the sinking ship together. We get to survive death together. But it is not just for us. It is for our family. It is for our friends. It is for anyone that we come in contact with. And I'm telling you, as sure as I'm standing right now, when I go out in my life and experience people who have nothing to do with AA, I carry every single principle that I've learned here with me, because that person deserves the benefit of what I've been given. You know? Yeah. And I didn't really have much use for other people when I got here, but it is my greatest joy to interact with people now. You know? And because I have been allowed to have my eyes open to who I am and what I'm about, I get to do that for other people, and I get to go to them and see them with an open heart and an open mind, instead of closing myself off to them, instead of judging them before I've even spoken to them, you know? And I never expected that when I got here. I figured I'd have to stop drinking, you know? Because I think somebody told me I needed to put the plug in the jug if I wanted to stick around. But that's all I expected, you know? And when I was doing service work, all I expected was that I was going to get to help out other alcoholics. And when I was in that relationship, all I expected was to be with, you know, somebody sober in a relationship. My expectations are so low, and I get so much. You know, today I get to open my heart to my higher power, my conception of a higher power, thank God for that, and I get to say, what next? Not, when's it going to end? When's the other shoe going to drop? You know, what next? And I am going to be 34 soon, and I'm telling you what, I'm about 4 years overdue. I had told my ex-husband at one point that I couldn't see growing old with him, because I figured that I'd be dead by 30. So I'm on borrowed time now, which is so beautiful, because that means that there were no plans for this time, which means I can make it whatever I need to. I can let my higher power direct me in whatever way that he sees fit. And that's pretty freeing, to not actually have any plans for this, you know, one foot in front of the other kind of deal. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. I never know how to finish up these talks. I really, really appreciate getting to come and share this with you tonight. I was not certain what was going to come out, but if you're struggling right now in sobriety, remember that being willing to believe is but a beginning. And if you stick with it, your higher power, whatever that concept is, will grow to meet whatever you need it to meet. And you will be able to walk through it sober if you want it more than anything else. And I really look forward to spending the rest of the weekend with you guys. Now that this is over.